This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 158, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. As we get to the end of the year, I thought it'd be fun to take a look back and highlight some of the amazing guests I've chatted with over this year. So in this episode, I have a number of clips from different episodes. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 150 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. So first we have Steve Neal. Steve's book, But Something Is There, is a journey through a lifetime of dealing with the unknown. Some call the experience the visitors, some call it abduction by aliens. The truth is we don't know what it is. So here's Steve.
You had two people, was it they turned up on your doorstep and one of them looked a bit like David Jacobs and the woman looked like one of your neighbors or something?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and I think I talked about it. She's even carrying a baby, but I don't know what happened to the baby when she got to the door. Yeah, that was very odd. And that was during that time when my wife was doing the Renaissance Fair, and she did the Renaissance Fair for years. She, being a Brit, she really loved the Renaissance period, and you know, she had a booth making trifle, real trifle, you know, not the stuff they do over here. And she left that. She left. Normally, she would leave on a Friday night. That time, she left Saturday morning to go out and then spend the weekend. And she hadn't been gone very long. And I noticed through the window, living room window, this car pull up, and I could see this woman sitting inside. And it looked like her friend that I knew. And she was wearing, a blue dress, and she had a baby. And then another car pulled up. And then the guy got out with the white hair, and he did look like David Jacobs. And they started coming towards the house. And I thought, who are these people, you know? And then they knocked on the door. And I opened up the door, and they're standing there. And I said, can I help you? And the guy said, you know who I am. You've read my books. And then they kind of pushed their way in. I mean, they took control of the moment. And I made no effort to resist them. It wasn't there. And I remember they took me and they turned me around and started walking me back towards the bedroom. They laid me down on the bed face down and they pulled down my robe. And because I'm still in my night clothes, and I remember them putting their hands on my back, and I just lost consciousness. When I woke up, I was face down on the bed where they had left me, and they were gone. Now, it's possible that whoever this was, they used the imagery they did to deceive me into opening the door. Because I'm always cautious about opening the door. If there's no one invited and somebody just drops by and I don't know who it is, it's really probably not the best idea to open the door to. You communicate with them to the door, and if they don't answer you the correct way, you ask them to leave. And if they don't leave, then you call the police, because people get shot gunned down in their doorway all the time. And being that I was being threatened and being stalked during that period, that made me extra cautious. So,
and also, I read about you seeing a guy who was fixing your roof, and he was he was up there, but he was, there was no ladder.
Yeah. Did I put that in the book? It's been a long time since I read the book.
Okay.
But you must have, because that must have been where it was. Yeah, it was very strange. I was in my shop. I had a beautiful shop attached to the house in Granada Hills, and I heard this noise, and I went out, and there's this guy, and he's working on the roof. And I can still see his face very, very clearly. And he had short hair, and it was kind of a sandy brunette, slightly receding hairline. He had very pocked skin from bad acne at one time, And I would have placed him in his late 40s, and he had a moth-eaten sweatshirt on. It was literally moth-eaten. It was just so strange, and these old jeans on, and his feet were kicked forward. And I realized that there was nothing supporting him. There was no ladder or anything. It was just this really odd moment. And I just sort of looked at him and I just said, hey, you're an alien. you know, just like that just came out of me. And at that moment, he kind of lowered down, came over to me. And next thing I knew, I'm standing in front of this visitor, like in the kitchen. It was taller, very similar. And it just looked at me like, and I remember telling Whitley about this. I said, Whitley, when it smiled at me, I could have sworn I saw teeth. There was something white in the mouth. He says, well, I've never seen teeth. I don't have teeth. I said, well, I don't know, because that's what I saw. And then it just started to spin and it became like a dust devil. And it went through down the alley from me, through the fence that led to the street where I take the trash cans out. And I ran over to the gate and looked over and watched it just slowly get slower and slower and dissipate and just disappear in the street, which is something I'm trying to reenact in the shows that I do. Because I've done visual effects for so many years in film. And of course I did, I'm one of the ones who did make a transition to 3D and worked in Lightwave and other 3D programs doing animation and creating wireframes and stuff. I made a really nice dust devil and I have a whole transition of that. So I'm going to be able to show people what I saw. And I do that in all the shows that we do as best I can. I reenact, not with actors, but just what I saw from my POV. So they can get an idea of what it was like to witness things like this. It was completely, it's nuts. It's just wacko. And you think you don't even want to tell people about it, but after reading the communion letters and Whitley's book and so many others that I read, I realized that I'm in no way alone with this.
So next is Robert Salas. Robert is a retired United States Air Force officer, and he witnessed firsthand a UFO disabling nuclear missiles. All 10 missiles in Echo flight at Malmstrom Air Force Base lost strategic alert within 10 seconds of each other.
Could you tell us how you got affected, first of all, with your interest? Is it from Malmstrom, or did you have any experiences before that?
No, I had no experiences before the Malmstrom incident, which happened in my case in March 24th, to be exact, of 1967. I was a U.S. Air Force missile launch officer assigned to Malmstrom and assigned to a crew, what we called a missile combat crew. And on that evening, I was at a place called Oscar Flight, which is an underground launch control center where we would be monitoring and, of course, affect the launch of nuclear missiles if so given that order. We were never given that order, of course. But on that evening, I was in command when I got a phone call from my topside guard. We were 60 feet underground. We had about six guards up top, and he reported that there were some strange lights in the sky hovering above the bay of the facility. Strange maneuvers, very fast, stopping in midair, reversing course, making 90-degree turns, things we've heard since pilots of the military pilots had reported their sightings fairly recently. At any rate, I was not interested in the UFO subject at the time, although we had reporting in the local newspaper. This was near Great Falls, Montana. We had reporting from various citizens that, of lights in the sky. And again, doing strange things. So I had heard about these lights, but this was the first experience I had with them. I thanked the security guard for the information, was not really all that interested, but then, so I hung up the call, and then about 5 minutes later or so, the next call came, and this time he was very frightened. I could tell by his voice he was extremely frightened. Had all the guards with their weapons drawn, and he said, "Sir, we're looking at a glowing red-orange object pulsating just above the front gate of our facility." And he wanted me to tell him what to do next. I was kind of shocked at the report, but it was certainly a serious report. It was not any kind of a joke. In fact, they had no ability to effectuate anything with regard to the missiles upstairs. We had all the controls downstairs. But at any rate, he was very frightened. I told him to make sure nothing entered the enclosed facility. There, we had it was obviously fenced, and to take whatever action he felt necessary. So he hung up because he had to go take care of a guard that got injured. This injury was not anything to do with the UFO, except that it probably had to do with some error or mistake. He had the guard with either his weapon or cut himself. It was a cut on the hand. At any rate, he had to go and hung up the phone. I immediately woke up my commander, who was taking a rest break. One of us had to be fully alert at all times, and the other could take a short rest break. And so I woke him up, and as I was starting to tell him about these phone calls, we got some bells and whistles and going off alarms. We both knew what that meant. It meant there was some problem with the missiles. So we took a look at our status board, and sure enough, the missiles were now going down. By going down, I meant they were no longer launchable. So we had a status reporting system. They were all reporting guidance and control system failure. And this was happening all happening while the object was still above us. We also had a couple of lights showing possible incursions at two of the facilities. The missiles themselves were at what we call the launch facilities, and they're located about a mile or two away from this launch control center. But we had to send guards out to those two facilities where they had possible incursions. And when the guards reported back, they reported seeing these strange lights out there at those facilities. And then my commander called the command post at the base. We were about 100 miles to the east of Great Falls, miles from Air Force Base. But of course, he had reported this incident, and they told him that the same thing had happened previously. Same thing had happened at another flight. And he told me that. I thought he meant that evening, but later on I realized and found out it happened 8 days earlier, and that was called the Echo flight. So very similar incident to mine, except they had security guards and maintenance people that had stayed overnight at two of those launch facilities. In the morning, they reported seeing UFOs above them. And within seconds of that report, all 10 of their missiles went down. So within the span of 8 days, 20 nuclear weapons, intercontinental ballistic missiles were disabled as a result of UFO encounters.
The next person we hear from is Robert Hunt. Robert has been abducted by aliens throughout his life. They started when Robert was only 7 years old, and they continue today. So can you tell us, what was your first experience? How did this start for you?
So this started on my seventh birthday, 1964. And we were living in London, Ontario, at 93 Beaconsfield Ave. And it was that night that my parents bought some Tammy 10 wallpaper. It was one of my favorite race cars. And for one of my birthday gifts, we wallpapered my bedroom. And that night, as I was laying in bed, and of course I had gone to sleep, I always slept with the light on because my bedroom was right beside the stairs going down to the basement. My sisters all slept in one large bedroom near the front of the house across from my parents. So I was sort of on my own back there, and the basement was a pretty scary place for a seven-year-old boy. So I always went to bed and I had the light on. My mother would stick her head in there sometime during the night, and she would see I was asleep and turn the light off. Sometime during the night, I really don't know what time that would be, I heard my closet door open. Now, my bedroom was very small, maybe 10 feet long by 8 feet wide, very, very small. And at the foot of the bed to the left was the closet. And right beside that was a window, outside window. And there was some light coming in that window from the service center next to us. So I had sort of a view of the bedroom, just not a great view with what little light was coming in. Now, what woke me up was a closet door opening. Now, this is a very old house. It was a wartime house. And it just everything on it was in rough shape. So as the door opened, the hinges made this huge squeak sound. Of course, that's what woke me. I was laying in bed. I looked over, and then the door started to open more. Now, I was terrified. So I was frozen. I just sort of stayed there staring at the door. And then eventually the door is fully opened. And this figure of something 4 feet, 3 feet tall, kind of hard to tell. I was laying down in bed, but it was very small, started coming towards my bed. Right then I pulled the sheets over my head and I was like petrified, but I also had this vibration through my body that I'd never experienced before. And it didn't hurt, but it was scary. So I was terrified and I felt this tug on the sheets and then a voice saying, "Don't be afraid, I'm your mother." Now, I knew that wasn't true. I knew that was not my mother, but for some reason, it did calm me. I felt some more tugs on the sheet and she said it again, "Don't be afraid, I'm your mother." And it actually did start to calm me. So I started to relax a bit, not shake as much because I was actually shaking, but that vibration was still there, which was scary in itself. Finally, I let go of the sheets and the sheets, she pulled them down and I turned my head and I looked at her. Now I say her only because of the female voice. Later, as I got to know them, I couldn't really tell the difference between a male and a female. They didn't use their mouths to talk. And I don't think I realized that during my first encounter. When she spoke to me, it was very different. It's like it was in my head, but I don't know if I realized that. All I realized that she was talking to me and I was hearing it in a very different way that I wasn't used to. I didn't really connect the dots till you know, months later. So anyways, I was looking at her and I was still very, very frightened, but not as frightened. But there were two other ones by the closet beside the door that they didn't follow her across the room. They sort of stayed at the closet door. And again, she took her hand up and she started to rub her hand through my hair. Now, my mother used to always do that when I wasn't feeling good. Anytime I was sick, she would sit there and rub her fingers through my hair and I'd fall asleep. As she was rubbing her fingers through my hair, she said a couple more times, "Don't be afraid, I'm your mother." And then basically I either passed out or fell asleep. I'm not sure what happened. In the morning when I woke up, of course, I jumped out of bed, went out to the kitchen, and the kitchen was right outside of my bedroom door. And of course, my mother was there. My sisters were just strolling in for breakfast. And I started to tell them my story of what happened. Of course, my sisters jump on saying that it was monsters from the basement and they're coming to get me and all that sort of nonsense stuff. And of course, my mom was chuckling because I don't think she believed me. And so I really was trying to explain to them that this really, really happened. And I was getting nowhere with them. So I sort of had to let it go. And then it happened two or three more times. And each time it would happen, it would be the same thing. They would come into my room, but this time she wasn't saying she was my mother. They would take my sheets off, take my pajamas off, and one would hold my hand. They wouldn't say anything to me, so I couldn't really tell, you know, I couldn't really tell if that was the one that said to you it was my mother or not. This blue-green light would fill the room, and I could look right up through the roof, and I could see the underneath underbelly of something. And at that time, I don't even think I was even aware of spaceships or any of that stuff. I'm not sure. I was only seven. So it would take me up, and one would be beside me holding my hand. The bed and everything would stay below me. So if I looked down, I could see everything there, but I had no sensation of movement. It was strange. It was like I was going up. I could see distance in my eyes. I could see I was moving, but I couldn't feel it. And the one would just hold my hand, and I think that was just a comfort thing. Just before we'd get to the bottom or the underbelly of this thing, I would pass out. I would wake up and I would be on a table already in a room, or I'd be on a stretcher, mobile, heading towards a room. So this went on for 2 or 3 months, and I would keep telling my mother the same story until one day, I guess, she had heard enough. And she basically said, if I continued to do this, these were just nightmares and nothing more, that I would get the strap. And as it turned out, I did end up getting the strap a couple times. Then my father actually got involved, and I got that from him. And so I realized at that point that I just had to keep this to myself. I just couldn't tell anyone. I just had to accept what was happening and sort of deny that it's actually happening, trying to convince myself that these were just nightmares and that they would eventually go away. Well, they didn't go away. It continued to the point where I was basically, I would be taken up and I'd either wake up in a room. The room would be all white, almost like the lighting came from the walls, the floor, the ceiling. It was really hard to tell the depth. You couldn't really say this room was 20 by 20 or 10 by 10. You just couldn't tell. It just seemed, with all the lighting from the walls, it could have been any size. I couldn't judge it because of that. They would come in through a door, but then that would, once it closed, you wouldn't be able to see where that door was. It would be completely gone. If I was able to get off the table and try to find the door, I wouldn't be able to. So they would do a procedure. And at the beginning, the procedure was pretty much the same. They would sit me up. Now, I was very low to the floor. I was 7 years old, so I'd be 4 feet maybe. They would turn me sideways. And if I stretched my foot down, my toes would touch the floor. So I was that low on this table or stretcher, whatever it was. The one would come behind me and hold me and lean my head back. The other one would come in front of me and would pick up this, looked like a darning needle, but it was either silver or glass. It was kind of hard to tell, but it might have been glass, but it was some type of material that you could sort of see through it. It was shiny. And he would say exactly what he was going to do. He was going to insert this in the corner of my eye beside my nose, and it would not hurt. Of course, I freaked out. I was fighting and everything, but they had a way of pacifying you where you'd have all the feelings of fear, but you couldn't do anything about it. Like, I couldn't jump off the table and run away. I couldn't take my arm and strike them. It was all I could do to even move my arm. So they sort of took away all my energy somehow. And he would put his hand under my chin. He would bring this rod up, and I would feel it when it would touch the corner of my eye. I mean, I was terrified. It was cold, but I didn't feel it go in. It was just cold. And then my head just lit up inside. So this bright light, and it was a white light, not like the sun, just white. And then colors sort of would wave through it, like blue, red, and they would sort of just wave back and forth. The other eye that I was looking out of would be normal. So somehow it didn't affect my other eye. Just the most of the time it was my left eye. I think a few times it did put it in my right, but it would last maybe, they would do it for maybe a minute or two. I was so terrified that, you know, keeping track of time wasn't something I was good at that age. It just seemed like a lot longer than I think it was, maybe a minute. Then they would take it out slowly. The light would all go away. And the one behind me would turn me sideways and lay me down. And there was no blood, no pain. It was over. And it was sort of a relief that it was over. So I wasn't as stressed out. I was just glad it was done. I would fall asleep or pass out, and I would wake up at home. Or I would wake up, and they would be taking me down the hallway, like in a stretcher, pulling me just like a nurse would pull you. And then I'd get to a room. They would take me off the stretcher and walk me in. And the door would open like you would think a door would slide sideways, like a pocket door. But you couldn't really see. It was just like a shiny door. I would walk in. It would close behind me. When I looked behind me, you couldn't see where the door was. The room was lit up like the other room. And sometimes the floor wasn't lit up, but most of the time it was lit up. But in that room, there was a small little table and a chair. That's all that was in the room. The being would set me down on the table, on the chair, and then he would walk out. And I'd just be sitting there. And then a lady's voice, and I knew this is the one that said she was my mother. She would say, "Hello, Robert. It's nice to see you again." And I knew that was her. Sometimes I would say hello. Most of the time, I wouldn't say anything because I was scared. And then she would say, you know, "We're going to do something." And at that point, it was all sort of foggy, almost like I was sedated. I would come in and out. So I would hear her voice. I'd sort of come to or come around or consciously aware. And she would be raising her voice like she's angry, not furious, but just trying to get a point across. I would be cowering, and I couldn't even know. I didn't even realize or know why I was cowering, but I was cowering from her voice. And then she would raise her voice again, and this pressure would be in my ears. It would hurt. So I took my hands, trying to stop whatever was hurting my ears, but I couldn't. And then she would say, "Robert, you're fine." Or Bobby, she used to say, "Bobby, you're fine." And then she would say something else. And if I didn't acknowledge her, the pressure got even worse. And then I would sort of pass out, I guess. Then I would come to. So this went on for quite a few of my abductions. I really don't know what they were trying to get me to learn or understand, and why they don't want me to know this. I don't have an answer for that, because really, why were they hiding it from me? I 7 years old, like, what could I possibly be telling me that they didn't really want me to share? Because that's the only reason I could think. I don't remember it because they don't want me to share it. But so that those things would happen. It would be sometimes they leave my pajamas on. If they left my pajamas on, I'd be going to that room where they were teaching. If they took my pajamas off, I'd be going to where they were doing the glass rod. I sort of figured that out over 5 or 6 months. It seemed to be a pattern.
So next we hear from Rhonda and Dwight Hull. In this segment, they describe a night of high strangeness after having many UFO encounters throughout their life. So can we talk about the really weird thing that happened where you saw it looked like a mobile home that just appeared?
Yeah, that was strange.
Yeah, and you know, we were, you know, at this point in our lives, and I guess I have to kind of make this point, you know, UFOs and aliens and anything like that, they weren't even on our radar, really. I mean,
We believed. We had sightings.
Yeah, but it wasn't really on our radar. We were both psychic mediums. We were both paranormal investigators. But yeah, when we saw that, we had just stepped out of our house to have the last cigarette of the night.
And this whole area, the whole neighborhood is mobile homes. So I want to preface that.
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, we look across the street, which normally is a vacant field with just
a fenced in area,
you know, kind of a round fenced in area across the street. But when we looked over this time, and it was dark, we saw what very much looked like a single wide mobile home within that fenced area. And we sat there and we were like, well, that's weird. How did they even get it in there, and how did they get it in so quick? And
how'd they get the power on? Because there was light coming from within this whatever it was. So we sat there trying to assess it for probably 30 minutes, walked to the edge of our fencing to get a closer look, but we could not figure it out.
And we, you know, from our vantage point, it looked just like a single wide mobile home with a, you know, with a door and maybe a couple windows on either side.
No glass and no physical door, but the doorways.
Right. We couldn't see in, but we could see light. And we were like, wow, that's strange. We'll have to check this out in the morning when we come out. So we just basically just kind of blew it off, went inside, went to bed, got up the next morning to come out and have the first morning cigarette. And there was nothing there. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. And I actually walked across the street to the lot. And I'm former military. So I, you know, the first thing I do is I look for tracks or any signs anybody's been there. And everything there was completely undisturbed. There were no marks. There were no tire tracks. There were no footprints. There was nothing. It was just completely bare. And that's when it really struck me, like, what the heck did we just see last night? And then it, you know, started sparking, you know, ideas as to what it could have been.
But it took us a few years to report it.
Yeah, we did report it to Phoenix MUFON. Yeah.
Next up is Paul Blake Smith. Paul came on the podcast to talk about his book, President Eisenhower's Close Encounters. He suggests President Eisenhower met with friendly aliens and that other American presidents likely renewed his secret agreement with the visitors. So what else did the president talk to the ETs about? Because there's rumors that he made a deal about they would give us technology, and that would, President Eisenhower said, okay, well, you give us technology, we'll turn the blind eye while you're doing scientific experiments and even leading to abductions.
Yeah, this is where the story gets a little dark, I suppose you could say. I don't think Eisenhower would be very permissive towards allowing human beings to be abducted and probed and taken without their permission. However, he did forge an agreement, apparently, according to eyewitnesses, that he asked the aliens to not show themselves overtly, to try to keep themselves hidden when coming and going here, and taking specimens and examining our plants, our animals, our human cultures, the state of our atmosphere and such. And he agreed that you could come and go here at a special base in Nevada, out in the middle of the desert. And I'll get to the source for this, but in a minute. And the aliens agreed to this, but they did want to take some examinations of human beings in a maybe a rural setting. And it's kind of fuzzy what Eisenhower agreed to, possibly that they could pick up some people as long as they didn't harm them and put them back, and made a list of who they were and handed the list over to American military officials. This may have been breached by that alien race, but I think it was breached by other races who felt this was their big opening to come in and abduct as many people as they want and treat them as rather ruthlessly as they want and hopefully put us back, like the gray cloned alien race that you see in so many stories and so much artwork and maybe depicted in movies, that you open up a kind of Pandora's box when you let one race in and possibly others arrive, and they want the same agreement, and they want to experiment on planet Earth and see what humans are made of and how they react to circumstances. So I think the humans proved to be fairly trustworthy, the human visitors, but others maybe not so much. Now, in 2017, a document was leaked, and it was turned over to a radio show host named Heather Wade, who's now out of the paranormal hosting business. But she gave me permission to print the document in my book, all but the last six pages, which were kind of critical, were printed by my publishers. They loused up the last six pages. So it's been included in my new book, The Nixon-Gleason Alien Encounter. And it talks about the conclusions of what our military and government officials who are in the know have put together on alien visitors. The document was written in January of 1989 as the outgoing Reagan administration was about to leave Washington, D.C., and the incoming new George H.W. Bush administration was taking over. And it's certainly an eye-opening document. I believe it's the real deal. I've spoken to other UFO researchers. They feel it's real. It's got very detailed, even complicated information on a couple of incidences, but it makes clear Eisenhower did meet with aliens in 54 and then later in 54 and again in February of 55. So that's amazing data. I looked it up in Eisenhower's digitized records. Could he have been available to meet on those specific days as noted in this document? And I found out it's possible he could have. They were on weekends when the press weren't covering him all that closely, and that he had a very weak schedule with very little going on that was printed in his digitized records. And as somebody pointed out, a president can always scrub his records and try to hide certain things or fudge times and days if he wanted to, so that you would not put in there, I met with aliens at Edwards Air Force Base tonight, and I was at home playing cards with the boys in Palm Springs that night. Something like that you would put in there. You're not going to reveal all your amazing top secret information. And certainly it would not be allowed to be digitized for the public to read. It's still pretty top secret stuff to this day.
Next, we hear from Elizabeth Anglin. On November 29, 1989, she found herself face to face with an alien in her apartment and realized this kind of event had happened before. David McKenna, and he saw you on a ship?
Right. So David McKenna and I were both in a gifted after school program for gifted students. And I was in the first year, and it was the first year the teacher, Alice Bailey, when she saw me coming down the pipe with this ridiculous IQ, she convinced, she was a sixth grade teacher, and I came down the pike and some other kids came down the pike with really high IQs. And she said, we need a gifted after school program. These guys are, they're bored. They're going to get bored. They need projects to do. They're going to be project learners. You're going to have to take the focus that they have and put it into something that they're interested in. So she started the program the first year I was in sixth grade. And that was fine. Everything was good. The year I was in seventh grade, David McKenna showed up. He was in sixth grade and he had a ridiculously high IQ. And, you know, and the problem was he was remembering all of his alien experiences and he was writing in his books about, you know, he was referring it all to the Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion, that the aliens weren't aliens, they were fairies, you know, and they were going to come and take us off the planet because the planet was going to crap and, you know, all of these other things. And we're in the Cold War, mind you. So like, if we do have a nuclear bomb hit, and even if we do in the future, it's not too far-fetched to think some aliens are going to come and take us off the planet. And anyway, he was saying, and they won't take everyone, but they'll take me and they'll take her. So David McKenna had seen me naked on a ship, because when they work on you, a lot of times you're naked. Okay. So you're a preteen girl, you're 7 years, seventh grader, you're going through puberty, and all of a sudden you have the sixth grader saying, staring at you saying, I've seen you naked. I've seen you naked on a ship. And you're going, you're a weirdo stalker, dude. Get the heck away from me. I quit the gifted after school program because David McKenna could not stop saying stuff about seeing me naked on a ship. And did I remember, and trying to telepathically have me look into his eyes like the aliens would look into your eyes. And I was just like, this weirdo won't leave me alone. And this is really uncomfortable. And all the other kids are going, what the heck is going on? So I was like, I'm out. I'm out of here. Just leave me alone. Don't even call me back. So what ended up happening is he kept talking about me to other friends that we had in common. And he kept all of these journals. And then my senior year and his junior year, he ended up dead, naked on the floor of his bedroom with a hole in his head that was cauterized with no blood. And the house was locked up and his dad was the sheriff. And it was all locked up.
So next, it's Kathleen Marden. In an episode earlier in the year, I talked to Kathleen about her book, Forbidden Knowledge,
A personal journey from alien abduction to spiritual transformation.
You've had all sorts of experiences, things you talk about in the book, and I wanted to ask you about some of those.
Okay.
There was one you were talking about, it seemed like a test that the ETs had you in this space. I think it was looked like it was a big open doorway or window in a craft, and you're quite high up, and there was a young man next to you, and they were saying to him, go on, just let go and lean forward into that space.
Yes, yes, that was a memory that I had of being on a very large triangular-shaped craft, I guess it was. I mean, I didn't see all of that craft, but it had appeared to have that shape to me. And I was like taken out onto a balcony with others, and this man I guess was trusted them. I did not trust them. I wanted all of this to end, and I couldn't make it end no matter how I tried. And they were attempting to show me that I wouldn't fall over the edge. And they had this man demonstrate this for me, that he would lean forward and he would not fall off the side of this craft. And it wasn't a pleasant experience for me at all. But it happened. And that's all I can say. I suffered trauma for many, many years until, you know, when I had hypnosis with Bud Hopkins, I met with Dr. John Mack. I had spoken to other people who were well known in the field about this, seeking some kind of support. Dr. James Harder from the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization hypnotized me back in the 1970s, the mid-1970s, about some events that I had experienced. And so there were people who knew about this, who gave me some one-on-one support, but I didn't really feel comfortable in my own skin until I met Denise Stoner after I moved to Florida. And Denise was such a very kind and supportive woman, and she investigated my case confidentially. She was Florida's chief investigator at the time for the Mutual UFO Network. She ran a support group for experiencers. And through this support group, I was able to actually speak in front of other experiencers for the first time. And I have to tell you, I just broke down, weeping and shaking while I was doing this. It was very embarrassing, but people were so supportive and kind. And after this happened, I felt as if a weight had been lifted off my shoulders. And I underwent hypnosis with Denise several times. I haven't revisited every event. I had no desire to do that, but I did collect a significant amount of evidence regarding what was happening to me. And I had the support of my family, my husband, which was extraordinarily important. Stanton Friedman, with whom I wrote three books. Your listeners probably know who he was, but he was a nuclear physicist and a highly regarded UFO investigator and known around the world. And at first he said, oh, I'll put this into my gray basket. But eventually I presented him with enough evidence that he said he did believe that this was happening to me as well. So I had all of this evidence. I was initially highly skeptical about my own experiences. I attempted to explain them away in any way that I could, just like I was taught as a UFO investigator by the Mutual UFO Network. But in the end, there was far too much evidence to say, no, I can dismiss all of this. And I taught myself, I was a hypnotherapist and a past life regressionist, and I taught myself rapid induction and to do this when these ETs entered my environment and to project love toward them. And when I was able to do that, everything changed. And they projected love back toward me. Whether it was genuine love or not, I don't know. But it made all the difference for me. And they started to let me remember information that they were giving me. And before that, I had some conscious recall of events that had occurred, information that had been passed to me, but it increased. And then eventually in 2016, I entered into that experiment with the Council of Eight and under Kevin Briggs, who was initially from the UK, who had moved to Florida with his wife. He had been a police officer in England, and his wife had worked in the psychology department at Leeds, I believe it was. And so all of my events changed after that. I was never taken again after the Council of Eight told me they would protect me. And so all of my physical contact being taken to craft ended in 2016, perhaps a little bit before that.
So next is Justin Bush. His life has been full of close UFO sightings, strange paranormal experiences, and multiple alien abductions.
When I did, my neighbor, he was 53 years old. He was, we knew him for a long time. I think he lived in that house probably 20, 30 years or something next to our house. He saw me go outside and he came out. And this man had problems with his legs, so he couldn't walk very, he needed a walker assistance. So when I heard him behind me, I had the weed whacker. And so I heard him kind of mumbling behind me. He was trying to yell to get my attention, but I couldn't hear him over the weed whacker. When I turned around and saw him, I was like, oh my gosh, are you okay? My first thought was there must be something wrong because he didn't have his walker and he was shaking, you know, his legs were shaking and he was standing there. And so I turned off the weed whacker and I was like, oh my gosh, are you okay? And he started yelling at me. And it was like I don't know how to explain this to people. It was like he was interrogating me. Like he, almost like it's so hard to explain. So what he told me was that he saw everything that happened the night before. He said that he woke up, he said 2:15. He went to the kitchen to get a drink of water. Out the window, he saw flashing lights above my house. He said he thought it was a helicopter. He saw this thing fly very slowly over the house, stop in midair, come down behind some trees in my backyard and land. This would have been about 15, 20 yards from his house and 15, 20 yards from my house. So he said he stood there and watched for almost a half hour everything that happened. And when he first approached me, it was like he was accusing me, like he was like accusing me of like being one of them or something. He was like, did you see it? Did you see it? And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, the helicopter. Did you see the helicopter? And I got frightened. And it was like, once he interrogated me a little bit, he realized that I wasn't like, I guess he realized like I wasn't with them or however you want to describe it. Just imagine you go to your window and you see your neighbor walking with a group of what could only be described as aliens. right, out to some craft that you just saw land in the backyard. He, when he first interrogated me, it was like he thought I was with him. And then once he realized how scared I was and how frightened I was and stuff like that, he kind of let off of me and was like, you know, we got to go. We got to tell somebody about this. He said, we got to go to the authorities. We got to tell people, you know, whatever. He described the craft. He described what he saw. He said that it landed very quietly. It didn't make any noise. He said when it lifted off the ground, it paused for a second. So it lifted a few feet off the ground and it sat in midair, and then it shot straight up. He said it shot straight up so fast that if you had blinked, you would have thought it had just disappeared. He said that it was so fast that I can't remember how he said it some other kind of way. He kind of re-emphasized it, but he basically said it shot straight up so fast. If you had blinked at the wrong moment, it would have been as if it just disappeared. Then he went on to say he had never seen anything move that fast in his entire life. And he started listing every single aircraft, rocket, missile, you know, everything he's ever seen. He was like, I've seen this and I've seen that and I've flown in this and I've flown in that. And I've never seen something move that fast in my entire life. And it was at that point I asked him. He said he had to sit down, that he was not feeling well and he couldn't stand up, and his legs hurt, so he couldn't stand up anymore. And I want to emphasize, this man wasn't like mentally ill. He had a injury, I believe, from the military, actually, but don't quote me on that, but he had an injury, so he just needed a walker to walk around. He was only 53. He was a very sharp man. But he basically said he saw everything. He said he couldn't stand any longer and he needed to sit down. And so I said, wait, where did you see it land? And he said, right there. And he pointed maybe 10 yards behind us, right where my dogs went and started attacking each other, sniffing the ground, making that big circle. And so anyway, he went inside. I walked over there to where he pointed, to where my dog's head went, and I couldn't see it from my vantage point where I was standing. But there was an 8-foot wide circle where there was no grass. I walk my dogs there in the backyard every day, every single day. And there's a big 8-foot wide circle where there's absolutely no grass at all. It was as if somebody went out there in the middle of the night and just cut all the grass out, shook the dirt out, tamped the dirt back down, and left and just took the grass away. Outside the 8-foot circle were three large indentations about 8 inches deep into the soil. They were probably about 8 to 12 inches long, maybe 6 to 8 inches wide. And they were kind of like rectangle shaped impressions, but they had a slight curve around the corners. There were three of those.
So next I'm talking to Greg Agigian. I talked to him about his book, After the Flying Saucers Came, A Global History of the UFO Phenomenon. His book tells the stories of people who have made up the ufology community, the military and defense units that investigate them, the scientists and psychologists who have researched these unexplained encounters. In this clip, he talks about a strange UFO encounter. At the beginning of the book, in the introduction, the first thing you talk about is Lyndia Morell.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what happened, what she says happened, and why did you have it as the intro?
It's a good question, right? So Lyndia Morell, this is in the early 1970s. She lives in New Hampshire, and she works as a masseuse, and she gets off of work very late at night and starts driving home. As you might imagine, it's New Hampshire. It's a fairly rural area. And of course, at like around 2:45 in the morning, it's pretty quiet out there. So she's driving home. And as she drives, she sees this bright light. And it gets larger and larger and larger. And she watches it for a while as she drives, smokes a cigarette, seems to go away for a while, but then it reappears, and she starts thinking to herself, "I, this strikes me as maybe one of those UFOs people talk about." Drives some more, and then I think, I can't remember if she goes around a bend or something like this. And then this object now is much lower and it's actually straight ahead of her, hovering over the street in front of her. And as she gets closer and closer, she says she has this experience of starting to feel like she can't control the steering. She's not in control of where she's going. And as she gets close, she starts to see this very strange object. It's kind of this a big kind of ball-like object, but it's made of hexagonal panels. And then she sees a kind of a window in there and actually sees a figure. And she thinks she hears the figure in her mind telling her not to worry, which doesn't have that effect at all on her. She really begins to panic and fears that this UFO is about to abduct her. And so she manages to drive into the driveway and lawn of a family house, knocks on the door, shouts, "Please, please come help me. I think there's this UFO after me." A policeman later shows up, takes the statements down, notes that, yes, everybody in the household is agitated. There's no sign that she's drunk or anything like that. And that's the kind of the end of the story. I chose it for a lot of reasons to begin the book. I thought, first of all, this isn't a story that lots of people know. I didn't want something that, you know, this is one that we've heard over and over and over again. It's a story of a pretty unassuming woman who by every measure seemed to be legitimately and sincerely affected. You've got some confirmation by some other people who at least can confirm her upset at the time. It exhibited some of the features of what a UFO was associated with in the 1970s. And then as I proceed to sort of talk about the case, it also raises the issue of, to me, the important question of where do we get stories like this? Not just her story in particular and the people around her, but you and I, that or anybody in, say, the 1970s or 80s who might have come across this story. Where do we get it from? How do we know about Lydia Morell's story? That, to me, is equally important, equally interesting to sort of get into. How the testimony and narratives that people have told about the things that have happened to them, how they get passed on. because we know that all the evidence indicates the vast majority of sightings never get reported to anyone who ever takes them down and records them, right? Most people either don't tell anybody or they tell like a family member or a friend. So that's kind of where I sort of try to then say, well, that's what this book is about. It's about how stories like Lydia get made and get told and get debated. And that becomes the focus of the book.
So next is Bonnie Jean Mitchell. Bonnie is a lifelong experiencer and contactee. She first saw the ETs when she was 4 years old. There was a thing that you talked about to do with hybrids. And I think there was something that happened that you say set the precedent for the visitations, and it was like a party.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so that was the first time that I met any of the hybrids. So the hybrids are, you know, they're a genetic mix of humans and star people. So the first time I met them, I think, I guess I was probably about 21 years old. And this was another time when I had just gone to bed at night. And I woke up and I was standing on a muddy mountainside. Just crazy how this happens. So I was awake and I really thought I was in my physical body. I thought I was there physically. And I was very aware. I mean, I could feel the temperature. I could feel the cool air. The ground was wet. There was tall grass. I could feel the moisture. You know, my feet were wet and my legs were wet. And there was a lot of mud. Apparently it had been raining. So I was on this mountainside. I was near the top. And as I was standing there, you know, coming to consciousness, I looked up and these two UFOs flew over and they looked really familiar to me. One of them was probably maybe it was a small one, maybe 10 foot or so in diameter. And it was kind of a light colored saucer and it had multicolored lights all around the outside of it. And the other UFO was bigger. More like 20, 25 foot in diameter. And it was kind of a dark color, almost like a dark gray with some black sections on it. And it really seemed like it was like a hard plastic looking. It didn't really look metallic. But that one in particular really looked familiar to me. And so I felt like I must know these people who were in the craft. And I waved and I smiled and I said hello, and these craft actually kind of tilted, like moved back and forth on their sides, like as if they were saying hello to me. And they went over the top of the hill and out of my sight. And so I started trying to run up the hill, but I slipped in the mud. It was just so real. I mean, so physical. And I fell on my knees in the mud, and I was just full of mud. I had mud on my legs and on my arms. And I scrambled up this hill and I had to use like, you know, big tufts of grass to help pull myself up the hill. And so I got up to the top and I saw these UFOs had landed. And there was a building there, which was like a one story, almost like made out of cinder blocks or brick or something. It had been painted white. It was one story. It was kind of a long rectangular building. And these UFOs had landed and beings were coming out of these craft. And some of them were human. Some of them were clearly star people. And then there were these beings who were hybrids. They were like a mix. They looked human and star person-ish at the same time. And oh gosh, I can't even explain how I felt. I was just kind of overwhelmed and I was standing there like with my mouth hanging open and my eyes were really wide. And, you know, I must have been a funny sight to them because I'm standing there, you know, all covered in mud and everything. And so they walked by and I was amazed by seeing all these beings. And they were going into this white building. And then another UFO landed and a star person walked out and he looked kind of familiar to me. And he was one that was kind of tall. He was probably like 5.5, maybe 6 foot tall. He had kind of creamy white skin. He had like more of a normal human-sized head, human-sized eyes, but he had no hair and his eyes were black. And he walked up to me and he was smiling and I mean, he could look at me and he could tell like what I was experiencing, what I was going through and how I felt. And he smiled and he said, "Don't worry, soon we'll be introduced to the earth." So I don't quite know what that means, but he asked me to come into the building with him. And so I did. And when I was inside, I saw just there was a lot of people in there. It was just a gathering of humans and star people and these hybrids, this mix, you know, and the star person that I went in with, he kind of went off and did his own thing. And so I was just standing there and just looking around at everything. And I ended up sitting down at a table. There were actually like little round tables with chairs and people were just sitting around talking to each other. And I sat down at a table with this being who looked rather human to me, but clearly he was not completely human. There's definitely something very different about his eyes But he had dark black hair, short black hair, and he had really bright green eyes. And I sat there and talked with him for a few minutes. And then I remember somebody was calling me, and it was probably that star person that I had walked into the building with to begin with. He was calling me, and I didn't hear him at first. He was like, come on, come on. He was calling me. And so I got up and I went towards the back of the room where he was. And I think that's probably all I can remember from it. Yeah. So that was the first time I met any hybrid beings. And, you know, they were already adults. They were full grown adults. And so that was my first introduction to them. But I did end up meeting more hybrids. And in fact, I actually took part in creating some of these hybrid children. Because in the early part of these visitations, I went through what you might call kind of typical alien abduction, where people will have physical exams and they'll have like sperm and ovum removed. And I did go through that. And so I was shown a number of times babies that were supposed to be mine, and little hybrid children that were supposedly mine. And it didn't make me feel weird at all, really, except for the fact that knowing that I have these children who don't live with me and they don't live on Earth. At least I don't think they live on Earth unless they're in a different frequency or something, but they seem to be living with the star people. And but I did get to meet a number of them, and they seem to be just really intelligent and have this kind of calm disposition. Like they definitely have human emotions and human qualities, but just very friendly and calm. And I think they're really well cared for and taken care of. So yeah, I definitely had years of experience with the hybrids.
Okay, so this week I hope you enjoyed all the clips I've put together. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, there is a 7-day free trial. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.